I am Gautam Kumra, Chairman of McKinsey Asia, and you are listening to the Future of Asia podcast series. The Asian century has begun. The region is now the world's largest economy. As Asia's economies evolve further, the region has the potential to fuel and shape the next normal. In each episode, we are going to feature conversations with leaders from across the region to discuss what Asia's rise means for businesses across the globe. Join us.
Hello, and welcome to the Future of Asia podcast. My name is Angela, and I'll be your host today. In honor of International Women's Day, this episode will look into the economic potential of investing in women's health. I'm joined by Mrinalini Mirkandini, a senior partner based out of McKinsey's Mumbai office, and Valentina Sartori, a partner based out of our Zurich office. Both have extensive experience in the healthcare and life sciences industries, with Valentina most recently co-authoring a new McKinsey Health Institute report, Closing the Women's Health Gap, a $1 trillion opportunity to improve lives and economies. The report, which was written in collaboration with the World Economic Forum, will be the starting point of our discussion today. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we get into the topic, could you tell us a bit about yourselves and what you're currently doing at the firm?
Hi, Angela. Thank you for having me on this podcast. I'm Mrinalini Mirkandini. I'm a senior partner at our office in Mumbai in India. Joined the firm nearly 25 years ago. I spent much of my career working with investors, both in healthcare and other domains, as well as with companies that focus on affordable healthcare. So this is a topic of great interest. Looking forward to the chat.
And good morning, good afternoon, everyone, depending on where you are. I'm Valentina. I'm a partner based out of Zurich. Been with McKinsey for a bit more than 17 years, so almost graduating teenage age. And I have spent the majority of my time working with the innovators in life science. I work a lot with the heads of R&D across larger, mid-sized and biotech firms to think about how they step change their innovation engine. And I'm very passionate about diversity and inclusion. And last year, I had the pleasure of working with some colleagues, Lucy Perez and Anouka Peterson, and the World Economic Forum on shedding some lights on the women's health topic. So this is my absolute favorite topic. It gives me a lot of energy. Angela, you will have to rein me in because I can go on forever.
Oh, I wouldn't dare. I think we are all very excited to hear your views on this. And actually segues quite nicely into our first question, which I'd like to throw over to you, Valentina. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about why you think women's health is such an important issue for businesses and society alike. Why should this be a priority topic for business leaders?
The first thing I would like to say is, what is women's health? Because a lot of people associate it with, it has to do with having ovaries, probably. Then it's related to fertility, contraception, and things that are only women. And this is absolutely true. But what we did is also redefine what women's health is, because it's not only those diseases that are unique in women, but are also conditions that are different in women. Take the cardiovascular diseases or how a heart attack manifests itself in women. Or conditions that affect women disproportionately, like autoimmune diseases. Take, how many people do you know that have migraine? Some people might have lupus or other systemic issues. So if you take this lens, women's health is very broad. And I guess if you think about it, all of you have a story of a woman that went through the healthcare system and maybe wasn't fully listened to, couldn't find a solution to her issue. It could be a friend of yours. It could be yourself. It could be a daughter, a sister. And for sure, you all have mothers, or you were born from a woman. So I'm pretty sure that this is relevant to everyone. That's why I think this is not an issue only for women or for specific companies focusing on, let's say, the first parts of the women-only condition, but it's an issue for everyone. I would say now what we did with our research was, number one, redefining women's health, as I just illustrated. And we found out that actually these diseases that are unique in women actually constitute only 5% of the total burden of disease, right, for women. It's quite impressive because we never knew that. And actually, those diseases that are disproportionately affecting women are more than 40% of the burden. And so if you think about it, then we said, okay, those diseases that are different in women or disproportionate in women are also visible in men, but there is a gap in the outcomes that you can achieve. And so the project was about saying, okay, can we close this gap? Number one. And number two is, if we do that, is there a benefit for society and for the economy? So we went about that, looking at all these diseases, and then understanding the literature, we looked at more than 600 papers to say, Are there proofs somehow on how you disaggregate data and show different outcomes for women and men in interventions? And how can we apply them to close this gap? And then we said, actually, in which age do these diseases manifest themselves? And a lot of people think, yeah, I think women live longer. That's why they're unhealthy, live less well than men. And it's true, women live longer, and actually they have 25% more of their life lived in poor health, but not fun fact, but the myth busted is this lower quality of life is not at the end of life, but is between the age of 20 and 60. 50% of this burden is between 20 and 60, which are the ages where you are studying, building your family, building your life, and contributing to your community, to society, you're working. And so if this healthcare gap manifests itself in these areas, it basically leads to women not being able to fully participate to society and also not living to the full potential. If you look at them specifically for age, I said that there is a 25% more of poor health for women. In Asia, it's 23%, and it's equivalent to 29 million years of life lost due to poor health. And it's almost 6 days a year per woman. Now, if we take all of this and then we say, okay, what does it mean economically? We try to close this gap through these interventions, and then we calculate what's the average GDP per country. So we did it really globally, but country by country. If we estimate then what's the contribution of GDP, if women are able to work more, participate more in every single activity, and we get to this huge 1 trillion number globally, which in Asia is basically almost 290 billion. Impressive, I find it. And of course, it's driven by China with almost 130 billion, Australia and India with 25 and 22 billion. I want to say the numbers probably look huge to everyone, but they are not, I think they're even an underestimation. We'll spend a little bit more of time later speaking about it. But one of the things we know for a fact is that even what I refer to, both the conditions unique in women and the different in women or disproportionate in women, are undercoded, I would say, in the system. So there is a significant data gap. And if you think about the methodology I just referred to, somehow we probably have data that is not fully representative of the magnitude of diseases. So this 1 trillion is almost the bare minimum we should try to achieve. And overall, we say if we take this lens, investing in women's health at a global level, we did a quick back of the envelope calculation, but it's almost saying if I invest $1, I can get $3 out. That sounds pretty good to me.
I agree. I think that sounds great. That would sound great to any business leader across the globe. So thank you, Valentina. You shared some staggering insights and you also shed some light on some of the issues women face along their healthcare journey. So Rinalini, from your perspective, were there any particularly surprising insights from the report?
There were, Angela, and I'll call out two in particular. I think surprise number one for me was the magnitude of inequity in research and development funding. And correspondingly, the huge opportunity that this signals. So, you know, for a cohort that's half the world's population, the fact that less than 1% of global research and innovation spend is invested in what Valentina called female-specific conditions beyond oncology, that number was staggering for me. Just 1%. And I think the implication of that is that there are conditions that are systematically overlooked. So the report talks about postpartum hemorrhage. Particularly in low-income countries, this is a big cause of maternal mortality. And there are just two new therapies developed in the last 30 years. Even if you take something like endometriosis, right? I mean, 1 in 10 women suffer from it, yet the number of assets in the pipeline are less than 20 or thereabouts. So I think the first surprise and staggering realization is many of us think of women's health as a niche. It's not a niche, actually. It's a massive opportunity, but the funding is niche. So that was surprise number one. And surprise number two, and again, Valentina alluded to this, is the science in which we put our trust is developed with the male biology in mind. And as a consequence, even the interventions on offer for very well-funded diseases are less effective for women than they are for men. So you start with clinical trials, women are not proportionately represented. You look at diagnostic protocols, often the risk markers take into account what affects a man. And then you move to the therapeutics, the same thing plays out. So if you take the example of something like cardiovascular disease, a heart attack does not discriminate. Both men and women get them. But if you are a woman, if you had a heart attack, you're twice as likely to die. You're also 7 times more likely to be misdiagnosed or to even be discharged during a heart attack. And this is because the symptoms you present with are not what you remember from the movies, clutching your chest in pain. It could be other symptoms as well, like nausea, indigestion, which are not often either known to the woman or part of the standard diagnostic protocols. Even if you move to something like asthma, one of the most common respiratory conditions around, many of the treatments which are mainstays are actually 20% less effective in women. So I think that was surprise number two for me, just how we put our trust in science, and I continue to believe the solution lies in science, but we do need a more equal science.
Thank you to both of you for sharing those great perspectives. I think we can all agree that although, as you mentioned, Rinalini, women's healthcare is seen as a niche market, it actually is not. It's just the funding that is niche. So when we think about that, what can the public and private sector do to narrow this health gap? Do you see any successful case studies that CEOs and business leaders can learn from in order to close this gap?
To me, she was describing very nicely somehow how there is a full journey, right? From experiencing symptoms, trying to getting some help, getting a treatment, and then continuing, right, and measuring your outcomes. And for me, there is an opportunity across this entire journey. And it starts, number one, then when I talk about symptoms, one needs to be more aware about on women's health. And it starts both with the women, but of course with the medical practice, with society. Think about one of my favorites lately is menopause. It has been not discussed. Every woman goes through it. I like to say, what is the condition where you kind of have 100% probability of having it? It's a great business opportunity if you want to address it. There is huge need. There is multiple symptoms. But because women historically didn't talk about it and it was perceived as you don't die of it, everybody manages it, so go with it. I think there has been a systemic lack of awareness of what are you going through. So number one, not talking about it doesn't help the getting at the bottom of it. And there is a problem of normalizing it. I don't think, let me say, normalizing the fact that you have a condition, on one side it could be good, but on the other side, it really creates discrimination. If you have symptoms that impair your ability of being productive, I think it should be everybody deserves to be taken seriously. But with that comes also the fact that in the medical practice, at times people have not been taught about some conditions, or to Brinalini's point, how to detect the difference in men and women and how these conditions. So in general, talking about it, raising awareness, but it translates into teaching the medical practice probably differently, not just with the male physiology in mind, but also thinking about how it is different in women. I think doctors in medical school get something like 5% around gynecological diseases. So this is nothing. So they feel also very unprepared. When you go to gynecologists talking about unique in women, even they don't get adequately prepared if I go back to menopause as an area. And now you might say, is it difficult to do? And the reality is we have seen great examples when we studied all this literature. We have seen great examples of when the data is disaggregated and when this women lens is taken. We have seen examples, for example, in hospitals in the US where a differential protocol was used, for example, for women undergoing a myocardial infarction or called STEMI. And so they go through catheterization and then a set of recovery treatments and you achieve better outcomes. So can you scale this? You probably can take it from one hospital to the other and scale it. It shouldn't cost a lot of money. Of course, you need to train your physicians. So number one, I will say awareness. And number two, I would say, again, from that comes sex-based medicine or sex-based care that, again, you need to scale. But it comes again to everybody being more aware. It should be the payers understanding that at the moment, the care that is being delivered to women is suboptimal and so clearly leads to longer time to diagnosis, wrong treatments, and so more cost for everyone. And so if we create this case for change and all stakeholders understand it, I think we have a chance to improve that. Where we have seen great progress, for example, is the vaccination for HPV in this sense. It was an area that a few years back, actually, both Merck and GSK as pharma company developed vaccines. And now there are concerted efforts across countries. I just read last week, Rinalini, you might know better than me, that in India, there is a concerted effort now to vaccinate all girls, which I think is an incredible story. Because cervical cancer can be deadly. And now if you use preventative medicine, of course, you can decrease massively the risk.
I do think, Valentina, the first thing you spoke about, right, just awareness and conversation, That's one of the biggest unlocks. Just building on your HPV story, we looked at the vaccine uptake in India. And one of the biggest reasons it's not what it should be, besides the usual affordability, etc., is just taboos. There's a belief that it's appropriate for girls only who are sexually active. And so it's not given to younger girls. And it's those kind of taboos and data which is just misrepresented or wrong that comes in the way. Beyond that, I think the two things I'd like to add to the list you laid out is, again, funding. There is a big opportunity for policymakers to dedicate more grants to women-specific diseases or conditions that affect women disproportionately or differently. This is also true for the private sector. I come from a geography where a lot of our healthcare spending is out of pocket. But wherever there has been an attempt to create awareness and an opportunity, you're seeing new segments emerge. Today, private sector investors are putting billions of dollars into fertility chains in India. People didn't talk about this 10 years ago. If you look at conditions like migraine that affects so much in terms of working woman health, what are the actual triggers and symptoms that can be diagnosed specific to women in the country? Big, big opportunity. So I think funding is one I'd bring back on the table, both private and public sector. And the other thing I talk about is policy. You know, there are many things that even people like us take for granted, like access to menstrual hygiene products, access to basic sanitation. But there are thousands and millions of women who don't have that. Because of that, they can't go to school, they can't work. And from there, where do you go? So I think just fixing what's unacceptable. And again, we've seen where governments have chosen to shine a spotlight on this. It's made a huge difference. So policy would be one big one. Also from the corporate side, better maternity benefits, better childcare, all of this, it's not unequal. It creates a level playing field.
I think those are all great points. And Valentina, would you like to jump in?
I think she triggered a thought in me around investors. Then it's interesting to see now new players coming into spending in these areas. I had a few conversations with private equity firms in the US. When you start telling them about the numbers in menopause, an area where pharmaceutical companies are investing very little, there are a couple of innovations now. You tell them the numbers, you say, in the United States, there are so many women, like 30 million every year that somehow will go through it. And then you say there is unmet need. They look at you in this squint and they say, tell me again these numbers. And nobody's investing. Why? Right? So it's very interesting to see these groups that are very return oriented now being very interested. And I hope that also with their renewed interest, this can push a little bit the needle, because again, it's an era when you speak to VC funds, they say, we would love to invest, but the science is not so clear. So it's hard for us to invest. So to Melanie's point, we need the entire ecosystem almost playing and putting efforts and energy to really move the needle.
I'm actually so excited by this whole femtech revolution, Valentina. I think in part because it doesn't only talk about the therapeutics, but also with digital, you can address taboos. Things you're not comfortable going to someone for, you can access solutions. So I think this marriage of technology and solutions that are specific to women, it's just so exciting, the power of what it could do. So hopefully we have a few billion-dollar companies that emerge and make the case for more.
I fully agree. And let me say, I'm probably older than the new generation. So a little bit go online, but you might go in Europe, you might go to a pharmacist, you might go to the doctor. So you need somehow to puzzle together all the information for yourself. But then to your point, if I look at this femtech, they provide platforms where you can access the information. You can maybe recognize yourself, oh, I have these symptoms. And then you find not only, okay, there is a drug that can help you, but almost the entire approach, a holistic approach on how do you get to the right doctor? What are non-medical interventions that you can try? And also what are potential medical approaches to address your conditions or where you should go to get the best care? I think this is really what we need, a full ecosystem approach that can help women navigate the system and get to the best possible care.
Thank you to you both for sharing your thoughts on this really important topic. It's become very clear that there is an immense opportunity in the women's healthcare field. But beyond that, there's just opportunity in general when it comes to addressing the needs of women. There's a lot of potential investments that can be made, etc. So with that in mind, I wanted to maybe take a step back away from healthcare a little bit and just ask what your hope is for the women's movement, women's rights, for International Women's Day. What do you hope can come out of this?
As I said, we've been in our network or in our family that have gone through some material experience. In my family, there is somebody that has had breast cancer, someone that has ovarian cancer. these people have been treated well. There are some people with rare autoimmune diseases for which no real cure exists. There is somebody who has gone through the healthcare system with problems breathing and is being told, it's all here in your head, seriously. And still the problem persists. So my hope for International Women's Day is that we all improve our awareness, our understanding, and we move the needle on how serious women are taken so that everybody can get the best possible care and can lead their best possible lives.
I couldn't agree more. I think my wish is more women in leadership roles. So more R&D heads, more investors, more policymakers, more CEOs. And that's simply because as a woman, the fact of the gap, but also the opportunity is so intuitive that you just know that women in leadership roles will act on it and change will follow.
Thank you to you both for sharing those aspirations. I think just based on your answers, as Valentino, you were saying, it's clear that we need to mobilize the whole ecosystem to ensure that all of these unmet needs can be met. So before we close the topic, I just wanted to ensure that either of you didn't have anything else you wanted to add.
Yeah, I think indeed women in leadership position, they gave us so much feedback even on the WEF saying, all of what you have is great, but I tell you, we move the needle only if more women are involved. But we need also more sponsorship from men. And we have seen fantastic sponsors, even CEOs. When people have similar stories in their family, somehow a light goes on. Because I think everybody feels, yes, of course we should do it. It's the right thing. But then there is still a level of hesitation on changing the practices, if you wish. We need more sponsorship from men, more awareness, and inviting this discussion as well.
And if I may add, I might just say as well that improving the health outcomes for women is not just for women. It improves everyone's well-being. So it's not an either or for men or for women. It's if you do one, the other will also benefit. And it goes both ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Valentina and Rinalini, for joining us today on the Future of Asia podcast. If you'd like to learn more about our research on closing the women's healthcare gap, you can visit mckinsey.com/womenshealthgap.
You have been listening to the Future of Asia podcast by McKinsey & Company. To learn more about McKinsey, our people, our latest thinking, visit us at mckinsey.com/futureofasia or find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook.